Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated.
Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar this week. Today on the show, the Trump administration continues to defy the rule of law, and Democrats really have only one option. Begin impeachment proceedings now. Igor Volsky from Guns Down America is going to be here to tell us how we can fight back against the NRA. I've got journalist Mike Stark, who's going to be here to tell us his personal story of how right-wing operatives are trying to silence journalists like himself. And of course, I will be taking your questions from Twitter. Just send them using the hashtag AskROF. And don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show commercial-free, become a member. That's the best way to support this show. That's ROFpodcast.com. And you can also support the show on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/TheRingOfFire. So let's get things started today with the biggest news of the week, which obviously the biggest news of the week, what everybody's talking about, and no, I'm not talking about Joe Biden, it is impeachment. You know, ever since last Thursday, when the heavily redacted Mueller report came out, that word has been thrown around a lot. It's been thrown around by people who say we shouldn't, by people who say we should, by people who say it doesn't matter. And to be honest, I initially fell into that last camp. Last Friday, I was talking about the fact that, yeah, you could begin impeachment proceedings. You could absolutely vote for impeachment in the House. You've got the votes. You've got the people. And then what? Then nothing, because the Senate's not going to vote to convict. We don't have the numbers there. But the more I thought about it, the more I read into that Mueller report, the more we look at the obstruction, the more we look at all of the other things that Donald Trump has allegedly done wrong, I don't think there's any other option at this point. Impeachment has to happen. And again, I say that knowing full well that this will not result in Donald Trump's removal from office. It absolutely will not result in the immediate removal of Donald Trump from office. However, just imagine this scenario here. We know after Bill Clinton's impeachment, his approval rating actually went up. He got more popular because it was a bit of a farce, to be honest. A farce pushed in part by Lindsey Graham. They got him for lying about his affair, and they impeached him for that. The Senate did not vote to convict and remove. But had Bill Clinton had to go through another election following that, he likely would not have been successful, even given the fact that his approval rating again did go up. Because suddenly you have to go out and you have to give a speech, you have to talk to voters, you have to sit there in a debate as an impeached president. You know, it's like the book The Scarlet Letter. He has this big eye for impeachment forever branded upon him. Even today, that brand is there. He was impeached. He wasn't removed, but he was impeached. And the same thing could very easily happen to Donald Trump. Not about the collusion. You know, the report specifically told us that too many people within the administration lied to the special prosecutor, so much so that it impeded the investigation and they were unable to find any direct link of collusion or treason or anything like that. But it's because of the lies from this administration. That's not saying that it doesn't exist. It's saying they couldn't establish it because everybody kept lying. That's an important distinction to make. But even beyond that, you don't even need that. That was always going to be something that would be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to actually prove and to put all the pieces together. But what we do have are 10 instances of obstruction of justice. 10 instances listed in that report where the special prosecutor's office was pretty sure Donald Trump absolutely obstructed justice and that the intent was to obstruct justice. Because that's also a very important distinction to make. Even though a crime wasn't committed, according to the heavily redacted document, you can still obstruct justice. However, if there was no intent, you cannot obstruct justice. That's just the way the law works. Agree with it if you want to, but if there is no intent, a court, a judge, anyone would have to say no. Without intent, you cannot have obstruction. But it's pretty obvious that we do have intent. We know what the intent was. The intent was to impede the investigation. The intent was to get people to not testify, to pledge loyalty to Trump over the rule of law or the United States or Barack Obama or whoever he wanted them to disavow that particular day. The evidence is there. That is more than enough for impeachment. But if it's not, okay, maybe those 10 instances for the Democrats, maybe they want more than that. Okay, well, you have Michael Cohen's testimony that Donald Trump committed bank fraud. I think that's pretty serious. Of course, you've got New York Attorney General up there really doing the heavy lifting on that one and making that a reality. But nonetheless, Democrats in Congress have a duty to uphold. And that duty is to essentially send a message, not just to Donald Trump, but to the American public and to the future. And that is, the president of the United States is not now, nor have they ever been, nor shall they ever be, above the law. Without an impeachment proceeding, we can't send that message. In fact, we send the opposite message if we do not start this. We send a message that this kind of behavior is okay. That obstruction of justice, if you're the president of the United States, is okay. And it can't be. It's not. The president is not above the law. And had it not been for that Justice Department memo from a couple decades ago, there is no doubt that Robert Mueller would have brought the obstruction charges against Donald Trump himself. He pretty much said as much in the report. But this administration has to be taught a lesson. And I don't want to say this, they have to have retribution. We have to get even with them. No. They are violating the law constantly. And I'm going to get more into that in just a few minutes. But even if we just base this on the report, even if we're only going by what we know from this heavily redacted report, the Democrats really have no choice but to begin these impeachment proceedings. And of course, it has the added benefit of having Trump have to run for re-election as an impeached president. He already has an approval rating that's now dropping into the mid-30s, tied for his lowest ever, because the public doesn't believe his lies that he was totally exonerated about the Mueller report. The wind is at your back, Democrats. The public is on your side, Democrats. In fact, the numbers show that more people are now likely to think Donald Trump did commit crimes following the release of it. They're telling you and they're sending you a message, do this now. And if you don't, it's not going to end well for the Democratic Party, and more importantly, for the United States. We have to take a quick break. There's a lot more news to cover. I'm going to talk about a lot more of these alleged crimes that the president has committed and that we know are being committed by this administration when we come back. I'm Farron Cousins, in for Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar today. Right now, I'm talking about the crimes of the Trump administration. Just a few minutes ago, I was talking about, you know, the obstruction mentioned in the Mueller report. Briefly hit on, you know, Michael Cohen implicating Donald Trump in financial and bank fraud. But Donald Trump's not the only member of this administration that appears to be committing crimes. Earlier this week, we had John Gore, from the DOJ, being instructed by William Barr, the Attorney General of the United States of America. Gore was told, do not comply with the subpoena from Congress to go and testify about that citizenship question that we put in the census. He was ordered to not comply with a subpoena. That's illegal. Just going to go ahead and throw that out there. That's illegal. But to be honest, John Gore is not the first person to not comply with a subpoena from this administration. We also have Carl Klein from the White House's Personnel Security Office, who has yet to comply with the request for documents, request for testimony, request for discussions, to figure out how in the heck all of these people from the Trump administration who were denied security clearances ended up getting them in the first place. What's happening in the entire West Wing, the executive branch of government, really, is that none of these people are following the rule of law. It is not just Donald Trump. It is the people he has surrounded himself with. And they're telling one another, do not comply with this. Heck, Donald Trump admitted earlier this week in an interview with the new Washington Post, he said, we're not going to comply anymore with any more investigations. We did everything we needed to with Mueller, which they didn't, but he said it. We did everything we needed to do, and so we're not going to comply with any of these other ones. We're not going to comply with them requesting my financial documents or my tax returns or testimonies or documents or anything else. We are done cooperating. It's what he said in that Washington Post interview. And unfortunately for him, that's not exactly how this works. But even worse, though, is that the Democrats who control Congress don't quite seem to understand that they actually can do something about this. There are mechanisms in place within the House of Representatives itself that give the Democrats the authority, the ability, and the tools to hold these people in contempt. One of those, and this is my favorite option out of all of them, is to have the Sergeant-at-Arms for the House of Representatives could march over to the White House right now and start arresting people for not complying and throw them in the little jail that they have and then keep them there until they have a trial in the House of Representatives. That's actually happened in the history of this country before, by the way. It could happen again today. The Sergeant-at-Arms would probably have to make a stop and pick up a few more pairs of handcuffs. I don't know how many they have, but I'm willing to bet they don't have enough. He could go to the White House. He could walk over to the DOJ. He could walk over to, you know, the Treasury Department and just start rounding up all these people and arresting them. They have that authority. They have that ability. That is well within their right. And it would be the legal thing to do right now, because none of these groups are complying with subpoenas and official requests. These are legal requests that they have to comply with. What would happen in that scenario? Again, the sergeant at arms would go, put them in handcuffs, take them away. They would then stand trial for contempt in the U.S. Congress. If convicted, there's possible there could be jail, but more than likely they would just be forced to give their testimony or forced to hand over these documents. And there's nothing that any court could do to stop this. Another option, which is something that is not going to happen given the mechanisms in place here, but they could also, you know, make a criminal referral to the DOJ, and then the DOJ could send a contempt citation to the U.S. attorney, a U.S. attorney with jurisdiction over that. But the DOJ is not going to do that, considering the DOJ is the one instructing people not to comply. So that mechanism, not exactly going to work. They also can seek a civil judgment from a federal court declaring that the individual in question is legally obligated to comply with the congressional subpoena. That is part of the rules. That is more desirable than going through the DOJ, but less desirable than having the sergeant at arms go around and start arresting people, because that's what needs to happen. That's what needs to happen more to these wealthy elite or powerful people in this country. That's why we have a lot of the problems we have, and not just with this administration. It's why we have Wall Street banks that continue to break the law and never seem to learn their lesson. It's why we have these massive corporations who think it's totally okay to dump these cancer-causing toxins into our rivers and waterways and aquifers because they only have to pay a few dollars and then they just get to walk away. Powerful people need to understand what it feels like to have handcuffs on their wrists. Powerful people need to understand what it feels like to be paraded around in the back of a cop car. That's what has to happen. Because for far too long, and again, I'm not just talking about this administration anymore, I'm talking about all of them, they have lived in these positions of power. They were essentially, most of them, born into positions of power and privilege. They've gotten away with everything, suffering from the worst cases of affluenza this country has ever seen. And they just continue to break the law and think that the rules don't apply to them, because they never have. Democrats in the House, we have these mechanisms, man. And one of the reasons, according to this piece in Washington Monthly, one of the reasons that they are not necessarily going with this is because it's time consuming. Oh, it's a lot of work, right? Probably a lot of paperwork to get the sergeant at arms to go out and start arresting people. And then you have to have a trial. And oh my gosh, who has time for that? The American public does. That's who. You do in Congress. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I hate to sound this way, but really, what kind of legislation are you going to get passed right now that has any shot at actually becoming a reality? Republicans in the Senate aren't going to let the Green New Deal go. They're not going to let Medicare for All become a reality. So why not work on this? It's literally all you can do right now. And you can send a message to every voter in this country, every voter who made the blue wave happen in November, and tell them, we heard you. We hear you now. We've got your back. We're not gonna let this go. The rule of law still means something in the United States, and we're going to make sure that this administration understands that. That is the message that Democrats have to send to the White House. We have to take a break, but when we come back, Igor Volsky from Guns Down America is going to join us to talk about his new book and how we can fight back against the NRA. So stay with us right here on Ring of Fire Radio.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar today. Nearly 100 people die every single day in the United States from gunshot wounds. We've got an epidemic of gun violence in this country that really only one party appears to be taking seriously. And thanks to the NRA's seemingly endless supply of campaign dollars, real action on gun control sometimes seems like a far-off dream. But believe it or not, things are changing in this country. And I have Igor Volsky, author of the new book Guns Down, with me right now to tell us why we should actually be hopeful for the future. So, Igor, first of all, thank you very much for joining us today. Very excited to have you on the show here. You've got this new book, Guns Down, How to Defeat the NRA and Build a Safer Future with Fewer Guns. Also, this great organization, you're the executive director of Guns Down America. So give us a quick rundown of what sparked this. You know, where did this organization and then the book, where did this come from?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. And the truth is, everything really happened by accident. It was December 2nd, 2015, the day of the shooting in San Bernardino, California. I was working on something entirely different, but had heard of the shooting that morning. And of course, you know, was as frustrated and angry and as upset as we all were. But towards the end of the day, I sat down at my computer, really for the first time that day, looked over at my screen and saw on my Twitter all of these lawmakers sending their thoughts and prayers over and over and over again. And, you know, that in and of itself isn't particularly novel. They do that after every mass shooting. But what really stuck out to me is that the lawmakers who were most vocal about thinking and praying were the ones who voted against expanding background checks in the aftermath of Newtown. Not only did they vote against that measure, but they also lied about it, misrepresented it. And so it really hit me that in the aftermath of tragedy, these lawmakers were trying to convince their constituents that they care about reducing gun deaths. But when they have a chance to actually do something about it, they do the opposite. And that gap between what lawmakers say and what lawmakers do, I think, is part of the ignition for a lot of my work in this area. But on this issue in particular, on that day in particular, it really angered me to a great degree. And so just out of nowhere, I decided that what I'm going to do is call all of these lawmakers out. And so I spent the next 8 hours calculating how much each member of Congress who tweeted their thoughts and prayers, how much they took from the NRA, and argued that the reason why they were just thinking and praying was because of those dollars and because of what those dollars represented. Now, you know, those tweets really went viral. They made international headlines, and they really gave me a platform to enter the gun control movement in a real way. And when I got there, what I saw were a lot of great organizations that were thinking about what can we get done in this Congress, what can we get done in the next. But there was no organized voice that was thinking about, well, what is our long-term goal? What are we all fighting for? There was no voice that was really asking for what we really needed in this movement. And so I thought that that was a real opportunity to make progress. And so we formed Guns Down America, the organization, with the goal of building a future with fewer guns. And the book really lays out both the policy and the advocacy roadmap for getting to that goal.
So what exactly is that policy roadmap? I know earlier this year we had H.R. 8, to expand these background checks, which it's worth noting, this expanding the background checks is something a majority of people in this country, including a majority of NRA members, they actually want this. I mean, it's like so many other issues we see in this country. Majority of people say, heck yeah, we want this to happen. And then it doesn't happen still. So where are we at with this?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, is that we're in a place where a majority of Americans not only support background checks, but they also support things like gun licensing, gun registration, gun buybacks, cracking down on the gun industry. And that's actually a piece of good news in this debate, is that, A, the American people support these kind of policies. And we know from experiences here in America with states that have adopted bolder policies, but more importantly overseas, that those policies actually work, right? So when you hear, particularly in this presidential cycle, the candidates talk about big ideas like single payer and Green New Deal, those are bold solutions, but they're very difficult solutions, right? We don't really have a roadmap for how do we take a multi-payer healthcare system and transform it into a single payer. We think we know, right? And people have a lot of plans for getting us there, but it's somewhat unclear. Climate change is probably even harder than that. But on this issue, we can see what other nations have done. We can see what other states have done, and we have a real model, a real template to follow. So, you know, you mentioned background checks that the House passed. That's an important first step. But what we also know from the latest research on point of purchase background checks, and these are the checks that once you're in the gun store and you pick out the gun that you want, you go up to the counter, they run an instant background check on you, and you can, if you pass, you can buy that weapon. We know from studies that have been conducted of California and other places that have these universal background checks that they don't have a population level impact. And what that means is they might, and they do, prevent folks from purchasing guns on a case-by-case basis, but they simply don't go far enough in reducing both firearm homicides and firearm suicides. So take, for instance, the recent example of the woman who was obsessed with the Columbine shooting and traveled from Miami to Denver, Colorado, bought a gun in Littleton, Colorado at a gun shop, passed an instant background check, and then, of course, as we know, terrorized the entire Columbine community and tragically committed suicide. That's a situation where she got through that instant background check, but if there was a tougher system in place, something like a licensing system, the kind that they have in places like Massachusetts and Connecticut, she would have had to go through a much more rigorous process and would not have been able to obtain that firearm. And that's part of the reason why you see in places like Massachusetts, Connecticut, there are 10 states in this country that have some version of a licensing system, that they've seen significant reductions in gun deaths of all kinds. So that's a piece of it. The two other pieces, in addition to making guns significantly harder to get, which is what I argue in the book, are one, really cracking down on the gun industry so that they're no longer producing militarized weapons for the civilian market. And then the third is investing in community-based violence intervention programs, the kind that hire local violence interrupters to change the norms in a community so that folks don't pick up the gun in the first place.
Let's pick up on that. We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to expand upon that point. So stay with us. We're going to be right back here.
On the heels of the critically acclaimed legal thriller, Law and Disorder, comes Law and Vengeance, the latest novel from famed trial attorney Mike Papantonio. Law and Vengeance follows the law firm of Bergman Dica Thomas, who is now in the crosshairs of a weapons manufacturer. But this is not a law firm that plays by all the rules. Based on a real case, Law and Vengeance, the riveting new legal thriller by Mike Papantonio, is available wherever books are sold.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins, in for Sam Cedar today. Right now, I'm talking with Igor Volsky about his new book, Guns Down, How to Defeat the NRA and Build a Safer Future with Fewer Guns. All right, so Igor, before the break, we were talking about, you know, ways to essentially make it more difficult for these dangerous individuals to get guns, work on, you know, community violence programs to help reduce violence in communities across the country. And one of the things that I think we also, you know, have to do as part of this, and this is something you've brought up plenty of times, I know Guns Down has talked about this, is regulating guns like automobiles. And I think that's a phenomenal idea. You know, if you want to have a driver's license, you're going to have to get car insurance. You have to make sure that you are accountable if you cause some kind of accident. You go through testing, you go through training, you go through all of these processes in order to be able to operate a motor vehicle here in the United States. You want a big vehicle, you want to drive a, you know, 18-wheeler? That's even more experience you have to get, more testing, more courses you have to go through. And why not do it with firearms? I mean, you know, if you want a handgun, that's a typical license, like a regular car license. You want a, you know, bigger class of weapon, you got to take more classes. I think this is a brilliant idea. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, yeah, Farron, I think the car example really offers a lot of great blueprint for how we can reduce gun deaths, from the licensing that you mentioned to the registration of the vehicle to the insuring of the vehicle. And those are all solutions I propose in the book. But, you know, the larger lesson, I think, from cars that we can learn is that the way we were able to reduce car fatalities, traffic fatalities in this country, wasn't by changing the behavior of more than 200 million drivers every single day. We recognized at a certain point that that was just unrealistic. That what we have to do, we recognized as the country and, you know, as the wider world, that we have to change the environment in which cars are purchased and in which cars are driven. And so what we did was we made cars themselves safer. We installed airbags and we installed seat belts. We made roads safer. We installed better lighting on those roads. We increased the standard for what it means to have a car license, to drive that car. And so I think the same lesson really applies to guns. And you mentioned this notion of keeping guns out of the hands of dangerous people. That's how our lawmakers or advocates have been talking about the issue for a very long time. But I argue in the book that it doesn't really make sense. It particularly doesn't make sense in a nation like ours, where two-thirds of the gun deaths are suicides. So who are those dangerous people exactly? They're certainly not walking around with dangerous written on their forehead anywhere. And so instead of thinking about dividing the world into responsible gun owners and dangerous people, I argue that what we actually need to do is what we did with cars, which is to improve the and to change the environment in which guns are produced and in which guns are purchased. Because when you change the entire environment for everybody, you make and create safer communities for everybody in those communities.
One of the biggest problems that we have right now is the fact that anytime there is any talk about expanded background checks, it immediately gets hammered by the NRA and by a lot of the NRA-sponsored politicians. It's an attack on the Second Amendment. Anytime you talk about doing anything different with the way firearms are sold or bought or purchased or held in the United States, it is immediately derided as an attack on the Second Amendment. So to me, that's one of the biggest things we have to overcome. So how do we do that? How do we explain that, no, this is not an attack on any of your constitutional rights? This is, we're trying to stop people from dying every single day. And we're at the point where almost 100 people every day are dying from guns in some way, either, you know, suicide or being shot. So how do we overcome? Because the talking points from the NRA and their ilk are so powerful, I guess. The public doesn't buy it, but the politicians buy it enough to where they don't do anything. So how do we overcome this?
Well, you know, the first thing I think to say is that even the most conservative of justices, for instance, Justice Antonin Scalia, the late justice who wrote the 2008 Supreme Court decision that for the first time found an individual right to own a firearm within the home, that even in that decision, Scalia made it clear that the government should and can play an active role in regulating Second Amendment rights, that those rights are not absolute in the same way that my free speech rights are not absolute, that I have to get a license or a permit, for instance, to hold a rally in a public place. That has been upheld by the court. And as a result, since that 2008 decision in Heller, the overwhelming majority of challenges on Second Amendment grounds to all kinds of gun control laws have been dismissed. So they've not been successful. So that's number one. So this notion that the Second Amendment, you know, is somehow in conflict with gun regulation just isn't true. And it isn't true according to people like Scalia. I think the second thing to really keep in mind is that the idea that the Second Amendment is in conflict with gun regulation is relatively new. It was really born in the beginning of the 1970s and into the mid-1970s as the NRA began to change the way it operated publicly. And so you begin to see for the first time the NRA and the gun industry funding different legal voices, funding different scholars to begin developing this idea that the Second Amendment and what the founders intended with the Second Amendment was actually far broader than we could have ever imagined. And they were fairly successful in that, right? They ultimately got the Supreme Court to expand the reach of the Second Amendment. They changed the public conversation around the Second Amendment. But it was almost entirely invented by the lobby. And I say that because in the early 70s, before you saw that public turn that the NRA experienced, they were actually writing in their internal documents, and I point this out in the book, that the Second Amendment, this is almost a direct quote, they wrote, the Second Amendment is of no use or is of limited use to our stated goals. So, you know, I think that's really something to keep in mind, that the reason why we have this popular notion, this false popular notion of what the Second Amendment is and what it represents, is really the result of very successful propaganda coming from the NRA.
And so what can the average person out there do? What action do they need to take to help get some kind of better regulation out there?
Yeah, I think number one is really educating yourself, your friends, your communities about the truth of this issue, some of the Second Amendment pieces that we talked about, but also the very real sense that we can't just stop at background checks, that we need to adopt bolder policies like licensing, registration, cracking down on the gun industry, that until we build a future with fewer guns, we're not going to eliminate this problem. So that's number one. And number two, the organization Guns Down America spends a lot of time thinking about, well, what can folks do? And so we just launched a campaign that folks can find at isyourbankloaded.org that is pushing the 15 largest banks to stop doing business with the gun industry until that industry can be fundamentally reformed. And our thinking here is that legislative change takes a lot of time, particularly on the federal level. But people are dying today. And so we have to engage all sectors of our society and all sectors of our community to do everything they can to help solve this problem. And so the goal of changing the way the gun industry does business, financially draining the most irresponsible companies in that industry, I think will help move us towards our ultimate goal of building that future with fewer guns. And of course, as a result, establishing safer communities.
Igor Volsky is the author of the new book, Guns Down, How to Defeat the NRA and Build a Safer Future with Fewer Guns. And after the break, we're going to take a look at Elizabeth Warren's plan to eliminate student loan debt. And I'm going to explain why that would be a major economic boost for this country. That's just ahead. So stay with us right here on Ring of Fire Radio.
Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I am Farron Cousins from Ring of Fire's YouTube channel. I am sitting in for Sam Cedar this week. This is hour two of the Ring of Fire Radio show. And I want to start this hour by talking about one of the biggest policy proposals that came out this week from Elizabeth Warren, which was not just debt-free college, but actual student loan debt forgiveness and cancellation. To me, by far, this is one of the most ambitious and sorely needed policies that we've seen so far, really, from any candidate. Obviously, yes, Medicare for all is a huge goal, something we have to do as a country. But this really kind of tapped into something that has been brewing, this anger among American citizens, which, let's be honest here, when you look at the statistics of who holds student loans, we have people in this country over the age of 65 that still have college student loans that they are paying off. Maybe they went to school later, whatever it is. This is something that does affect every demographic, and it's something we have to do. But immediately after, you know, this proposal came out, made all the headlines, you had the right wingers and you had people like Ben Shapiro. Ben Shapiro comes out on Twitter and attacks her plan and says, why stop there? Why not go for all debt forgiveness from any lender? Well, heck yeah, Ben, sign us up. I think everybody would love that. And I think that would be a huge boon to the U.S. economy. And I'm not saying that lightly. I've done the math. Now, I haven't done the math about all debt in the United States, but I did take it upon myself, actually Tuesday evening, got a little bored. And so I did some research, pulled up the statistics, started doing some math, and it turns out that canceling all the student loan debt here in the United States would be one of the biggest financial booms the U.S. economy has ever seen, ever, ever. And here's how I explain this on my Twitter feed. But I, you know, you can't really get into the details and how you reach these conclusions on in a Twitter post, no matter how many threads you do on it. So I want to explain it in depth right here, right now. Currently, $1.5 trillion in student loan debt being held by 45 million people here in the United States. 45 million people have student loan debt and would potentially, under Warren's plan, qualify for this student loan debt forgiveness. Obviously, there are income thresholds. If you're, you know, super wealthy or even just very well off, you would not qualify under her plan. But of the 45 million, the average monthly payment is roughly $280 per month. So it's 45 million people paying $280 every single month. Now, if you don't think that is a ton of money, you're absolutely mistaken, because we're talking about $12.6 billion every month being paid on student loans on average. So $12.6 billion per month is what we are currently paying. So debt cancellation would be $12.6 billion a month that suddenly is freed up. That's not going to these lenders. It's not going to the banks. It's money that 45 million people would suddenly have to spend. Well, okay. As I mentioned, not everybody would qualify for this student loan debt relief. So let's say only, let's go very conservative, let's say only half qualify for student loan debt relief. Okay. Now we're looking at only $6.3 billion being able to be freed up each month. That's still a ton of money, $6.3 billion every single month. Factor in that 80% of people in this country live paycheck to paycheck. And a lot of that group also has to live off of credit cards. So they're living beyond their paycheck each month. So 80% paycheck to paycheck, which means 80% of people in this country spend 100% of the money they get each month. At that point, conservatively, again, the number would be much higher than this. We would be looking at $5.04 billion in new economic spending every single month of the year. $5 billion that suddenly is going back into the economy. It's not going to a bank. It's not going to pay down interest rates for these loans. It's $5 billion in new economic spending from tens of millions of Americans who would qualify for this student loan debt relief cancellation. $5 billion. And here's the other side of this coin. Many student loans, I know a lot of the ones I still hold, are actually held by the federal government or underwritten by the federal government. So yes, if we cancel loan, the government's going to lose money. But then suddenly, We've got $5 billion in new economic activity every single month, and that's going to pay local taxes, sales taxes. It's going to create new jobs that are going to create new payroll taxes. Businesses are going to be making more income because of that additional $5 billion being spent every single month. That's going to generate so much revenue for the federal government. So while conservatives are out there whining about how much money we're going to lose, they're doing that because they haven't done the math. They're doing it because they haven't looked at the numbers, and they're doing it because they're intentionally trying to mislead the public. That's the goal. That's the point. That's why they talk about it. But $5 billion in new economic activity every single month is transformational. That is something that is going to fundamentally change for the good the United States economy. And all we have to do is let the big banks take this one-time hit. You know what? The TARP program, the bailout program for the big banks, cost us $700 billion just as the initial price tag. It's actually a lot higher than that now. But $700 billion we handed to the banks after they screwed up. They knew they were screwing up. They did it because they thought they could make money. They failed. So we bailed them out. Well, now it's time to bail out the student loan holders who have been screwed over by these big banks, who have been victims of this system, victims of unfair college tuition price hikes. So, yeah, this makes sense because all of that saved money, nearly all of it, 80% of it at least, is immediately going back into the economy. Yeah. Banks may lose a little bit more money because people may not have to put everything on credit cards anymore. But you know what? I think that's a hit I'm willing to take, and I think that's a hit a lot of people in this country would be willing for the banks to take. After everything they have done to us, after everything they're doing today, yeah, to hell with the big banks. They've had it too good for too long, and they can take this one-time financial hit so that we can boost the economy, boost revenues for the federal government, increase employment, and provide millions upon millions of people with a chance at a better future. We need to take a quick break, but I've got lots to say, including the idea to let felons vote from prison, all that coming up just after the break. And don't forget, you can catch new videos from us here at Ring of Fire 7 days a week on our YouTube channel. Subscribe today at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. We'll be right back.
Well, maybe it's the common curse. Maybe things get bad before they get worse. I don't want to become someone who can't live up to what I already done. Don't keep it just to figure it out. Well, it rains and pours and then it runs out. I was crying on the bathroom floor. And just when I thought I could take no more, well...
Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
One, two. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I am Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar this week. If you're not already, please make sure that you subscribe to the Ring of Fire YouTube channel. Just go to youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. Five new videos every single day of the week. We also have a special section for members with early access videos. You can also find that on our Patreon at patreon.com/TheRingOfFire. If you want to help support what we do here, I encourage you, become a member, subscribe to the YouTube channel, help us on Patreon, whatever your method, preferred method is there, the YouTube members or the Patreon. We always appreciate it, and thank you so much. Let's get back to some of the news of this week. Just a few minutes ago, I was talking about the proposal from Elizabeth Warren for the student loan debt cancellation. We also obviously have major proposals, a lot of them from Elizabeth Warren. But other big ideas from candidates: Medicare for all. We've got the Green New Deal. We've got a $15 an hour living wage. We also have something that made headlines all week: felons voting, people voting from prison. Now, obviously, this drew a lot of negative attention and a lot of reactive posts on Twitter and social media, because on the CNN Town Hall Monday night, they asked Bernie, should the Boston Marathon bomber be allowed to vote from jail? And oh my God, suddenly Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, who supported as well, they think terrorists should be allowed to vote. How awful is that, folks, right? Well, here's the thing. When counting the census, when doing the census, when drawing congressional maps, when allocating funding from the federal government, we count prison populations. Those that are United States citizens still retain their citizenship while they're in prison. Again, they're part of the census. Two states, Vermont and Maine, already let them vote. So what's the problem? Honestly, what's the problem? And the problem is, again, with the way the right-wing media and these right-wing pundits and these right-wing Twitter stars frame it, is that Democrats want to let terrorists vote. That's not true. That's not the way it is. What's happening in the United States today is that we have a very, very well-oiled voter suppression machine. And what that machine does is it locks people away from minor offenses. And suddenly, you're a felon. Well, guess what? In a lot of states across this country, once you have that stigma of being a felon, once you go to prison, your right to vote is gone. Even when you get out. You know, the disenfranchisement of felons in the United States is one of the biggest voter suppression efforts that we have ever seen. And it's been going on for decades and decades. I mean, here in my home state of Florida, they just this past November had a constitutional amendment on the ballot, which passed with over 60% of the vote, giving former felons their right to vote back. These are people who had served their time. They were free, had been out of prison, some of them for years and years and years, but weren't allowed to vote. Now they can. But, of course, the caveat on that is that we have a Republican-controlled legislature that is actively trying to prevent them from being able to register to vote by instituting what is essentially a poll tax, by saying, okay, if you want your right to vote back, even though we constitutionally have to give it to you, we're going to unconstitutionally demand that you repay all court costs associated with your prosecution, something that we did not demand prior to this amendment passing, but we're just randomly going to demand it now. It is a modern-day poll tax instituted by the Republicans here in the state of Florida to prevent 1.4 million new voters from being able to register. 1.4 million new voters in this state of Florida fundamentally changes the electorate here forever. Forever. We haven't had a single major election in this state that was decided by fewer than 500,000 votes since before the year 2000. Let me put it that way. That's how close races are down here in Florida. But back to this issue of should people be able to vote from prison. I don't even understand why we're having this conversation. Yes, they should. And Kamala Harris, what drove me crazy is that when she was asked this on CNN, she said, this is a conversation we should be having. Okay, we'll have it. You're literally in a situation where they say, hey, let's have this discussion. And your answer is, oh, we should have a discussion about that. Yes. No, that was the time. That was the place. That was when it was supposed to happen. But we don't have to have a conversation about this. Yes, felons should be allowed to vote from prison. They are counted in the census. They are directly affected by policy. In some instances, you know, policy to build new private prisons and ship these people over there, where they're going to be treated even more inhumanely than they are in regular prison, where they have higher chances of being abused, where they have greater chances of being killed, where they're left with unskilled guards who will also abuse them along with the fellow inmates. So yes, they should have a say in our democracy. Now, I know people want to draw lines. They say, okay, should a rapist be allowed to vote? Should somebody who killed 15 people, should they get to vote? They're still citizens. They're still Americans. They're still people. People do horrible things. People do horrible things all the time that aren't in prison. We have corporate CEOs. And from years of working at with Mike Papantonio, I've seen documents. And you see these executives make decisions that they know are going to kill hundreds of people or thousands of people. They get to vote. Just because they haven't been prosecuted for it shouldn't change anything. They made the decision to kill people, and they still get to vote. I don't see what separates them from the people in prison. We have to take another break. When we come back, Mike Stark is going to be here to tell us how conservatives are targeting journalists here in the United States and trying to silence them. I'm Farron Cousins, in for Sam Cedar, and you're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back.
I had a dream about a burning house. You were stuck inside, I couldn't get you out. I laid beside you and pulled you close.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins, in for Sam Cedar this week. You know, last week, Reporters Without Borders released a new report showing that the United States has fallen even further in their press freedom index. The report also showed that violence and threats against journalists across the globe are all on the rise. And part of the reason why things are getting so bad, at least here in the U.S., is because of the right-wing attack on journalists. And I actually have investigative journalist Mike Stark with me now to talk about his personal experience of being targeted by these right-wing operatives. So, Mike, I've been following your story. I've been reading what's happening. I follow you on Twitter. I read your diary here on Daily Kos. This is a very chilling story. The attack on you, essentially, your credibility, your career, what you're doing, has now become a major legal battle because you have been accused of assault. And this is sadly exactly what you had predicted would happen. But I'm probably getting ahead of myself right now. Take it from the beginning. Tell us this story of what has happened to you over these last few months here.
Yeah, so actually, careful what you wish for, because this is actually maybe the third and a half chapter in this story. The first chapter begins in Virginia. I'm covering Ed Gillespie, and you know, I'm hired by Cher Blue to go to each one of his campaign events and ask him questions that, you know, a Democrat would ask a Republican, you know, questions designed to hold him accountable. And the first question I ask him, I say, hey, look, Ed, the whole world knew that tobacco companies were marketing their product to children by using cartoons, and that they were manipulating nicotine levels to make their product more addictive. And they were lying about what they knew about its cancer-causing properties. The whole world knew all that, and that's when you decided that a good job for you would be for you to be a lobbyist for tobacco companies. Walk me through that moral calculus. How did you come to that decision? And, you know, give him credit. He talked a good game, and everybody needs a lobbyist, and da-da-da, and the Virginia tobacco growers and all the rest. But from that point forward, at every single campaign event he could, in other words, every single campaign event that wasn't held in a public place, he would have me removed. He would have the owner of the appliance shop tell me I'm trespassing if I don't go. So I'm an attorney too. I know trespass laws. I have to go when I'm told to leave private property. So I'm reduced to ambushing him as he arrives at events before anybody can tell me to leave, leaving right away after the ambush, showing back up at the conclusion of the event to catch him on his way to the car, again, before anybody can tell me to leave the property. And I'm asking them questions like, after Las Vegas, why won't you release your NRA questionnaire and share with Virginians exactly where you stand on guns? After the Charlottesville, you know, white supremacy riots, why do you still have George Allen, the noted racist senator who kept a Confederate flag and a noose in his office? Why is he still a senior advisor to your campaign? Why does he occupy a senior position in your campaign? So I've got all these videos that we've put up. And then comes time for a public parade in Annandale, Virginia, which is one of the most diverse areas of Virginia. And he's at this time running a lot of MS-13 ads that everybody with any kind of conscience at all understood to be utterly racist. And my plan is to walk up and down this parade route with him, asking him about those MS-13 ads, catching him on film as he's shaking hands. He definitely doesn't want that to happen. So what he does is he calls the police and says, I've got this shadowy figure lurking about my bus. He looks dangerous to me. Can you do something about him? The police tell me, stay away from him. I said, well, I'm a reporter, and I'm going to do my job. If you don't want me to, you're going to have to arrest me. The cop says to me, don't F with me. He swears at me. And now, old Marine, you know, I think the Constitution means something. We're off the races. I'm swearing back at the cops. And before you know it, I'm down on the ground. I've got six cops pounding on me. And there's video of this. You'll find this at Daily Kos, too. Six cops pounding on me, and I go to jail for swearing at police. But the point is that Ed Gillespie lied about who I was, and that set the table for the police aggression that followed. Fast forward to March 2018. I'm covering Ryan Zinke hearing, a budget hearing on the Hill. I've had some fantastic successes, videos getting tens of millions of, not tens of millions, 10 million views after Parkland and stuff like that. Republicans are telling me on the Hill, you're not welcome here. The committees had an agreement that we wouldn't have people up here harassing members. I said, well, I'm not part of the committee. I'm a reporter, and I'm going to hold you accountable for all this, you know, family separation stuff, and you're not going to stop me from coming up here. A Republican told me there will be consequences if you persist. And sure enough, I'm covering the Sinky hearing, and Heather Swift, his press secretary, as we're exiting the room, takes a sharp step to her left, slams her hip into me, then looks up at me and says, hey, stop pushing. I'm arrested. I go to jail. The good thing about all of these different arrests is I've always got my GoPro going. It's a wide-angle lens so that when I get in front of the judge, we play the video, and I'm exonerated. That doesn't stop me from incurring $13,000 in legal fees. It doesn't stop me from spending the night in jail. And most importantly, what ends up happening is while I'm in jail, they run to the press and complain that Mike Stark assaulted a woman. It goes to CNN. It goes to Politico. They report on American Bridge employee Mike Stark, so they're smearing my employer as well. I'm in jail. I can't defend myself. And by the time I get out of jail, the news cycle has passed, and nobody really cares. Nobody wants to hear from me. By the time 6 months pass and I go to court and I'm exonerated with the judge saying that I'm credible and Heather Swift is not credible, again, you get one story from E&E News, you know, essentially a trade journal, that reports that, and all the other CNN, Politico, Washington Post, they don't correct anything. So if you Google Mike Stark right now, you'll see these series of articles about Mike Stark assaulting women. Exactly part of their plan. That brings me to Nevada. I'm out there to, after being exonerated in September for the Heather Swift incident, I'm out there to cover Adam Laxalt. He's got 30 pages of sealed arrest records. At the time, he's the Attorney General of Nevada. He's running for governor, and he won't release his 30 pages of sealed arrest records. Now, we know that one of those arrests was for assaulting a police officer. So it's my job to go out there and ask him, aside from the police officer, have you beaten anyone else up? Have you been arrested for beating anyone else up? Are you a violent person? The minute he sees me with my camera, he turns and runs. Now, as a reporter, as an accountability reporter, if somebody's running from you, that's a strong indication that you're on the right track. And I'm going to go get the story. So I follow him. He goes into a side room with his campaign manager, a woman named Kristen Davison, and a guy named Ryan Keller, who was the deputy campaign chief for the state of Iowa for Donald Trump. They go into a room. I hold the door open and try to get in myself. Davison launches herself into me. Small woman, but she launches her elbow up into my armpit and her wrist up into my throat, and she's trying to push me back. Look, I've got a legal right to go into that room. It's a Las Vegas, East Las Vegas Community Center. You have no right to stop me from going in there. When you use your body to stop me from going to a place I have a legal right to go, that's an assault on me. So things get crazy, and the cops come, and I explain all this to the police. And again, we've got video up of this at Daily Coast, I think on my GoFundMe page and all the rest. So you can see for yourself what ended up happening. But the police show up, and I explain to the police, look, when you go into Republican events as a Democratic partisan reporter, you are a skunk at the picnic, and everybody is trying to kick you. And that's what happened here. But they won't tell you the truth about what happened. So what you're going to need to do is you're going to need to look at the venue security camera footage before you make any charging decisions. Otherwise, you're going to make the wrong decision because you've got an attorney general that's going to tell you something. You've got a former governor, Bob List, that's going to tell you something. You've got a very powerful lawyer here, Joe Brown, who sat on the Nevada Gaming Commission and stuff like that, Republican. He's going to tell – they're all going to lie, and they're all going to say that I was some kind of crazy person that came in here swinging on these people. And that's essentially what they did. What they said was I grabbed Kristen Davison, wrenched her arm behind her back, jacked her up against the wall, and shouted over to Adam Laxalt, you can stop this, Adam. You can stop this. Of course, I did nothing at all like that.
Well, I hate to interrupt you there. We have to take a quick break real quick, but let's pick up with that as soon as we come back. I'm Farron Cousins, and for Sam Cedar, you're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. We're going to be right back with more from journalist Mike Stark.
On the heels of the critically acclaimed legal thriller, Law and Disorder, comes Law and Vengeance, the latest novel from famed trial attorney Mike Papantonio. Law and Vengeance follows the law firm of Bergman Dica Thomas, who is now in the crosshairs of a weapons manufacturer. But this is not a law firm that plays by all the rules. Based on a real case, Law and Vengeance, the riveting new legal thriller by Mike Papantonio, is available wherever books are sold.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar this week. I am talking with journalist Mike Stark. And Mike, right before the break, I unfortunately had to cut you off. You were right at the heart of your story here about this arrest last fall. Pick up right where you had left off there. This is a phenomenal story, so let's get back into it.
Sure. So I've explained to the police at this point that they're not going to get the truth from these partisan witnesses. There's eight Republicans there, and there's only one of me. I know what I did, and I'm telling you the truth. But you can verify the truth, and you should verify the truth by going ahead and looking at the venue security camera footage. And I point out all the security cameras, and the policeman says to me, well, you're in luck, because this venue was actually chosen because of its saturation level of security camera footage. So I'm feeling pretty good about myself. He finishes the interview with me and has me wait with his partner. While I'm waiting with his partner, I said, geez, I hate that this is happening, but this is what happens when a Democrat covers a Republican event. And I really can't go to jail because I got a flight out tonight. I got to get to Oklahoma to do another event like this. And the cop says to me, there's no way you're going to jail. You didn't punch anybody. Nobody's got a bloody lip. Nobody's got a black eye. You don't go to jail for these kind of pushing and shoving types of things. That just doesn't happen. 3 minutes later, the original police officer came outside. Hey, I got to frisk you. Put your hands behind your back. And he puts the handcuffs on, and I'm in a patrol car. Now, this is what's interesting. I faced trial, and all the security camera footage disappeared. The police body camera footage, which is important because it will show that from the beginning, I gave a narrative event of events that would have corresponded exactly with the venue security footage and does correspond exactly with the footage that another activist happened to record, luckily for me. So that would have helped my credibility, but really where it would have been helpful is when he did all his witness interviews and these guys told a coordinated story that doesn't match up with the video that I have to enter into evidence, we'd be able to discredit, you know, some people that would otherwise be held to be more credible than this reporter, a former governor, an attorney general running for governor. So you know how it is when you go to court, the police or the judge almost always believes the police over the citizen. Double that or triple that for believing the governor over the reporter or the attorney general over the reporter. So all this evidence is gone. The police body cam footage, the footage of me in the patrol car, and like I said, most importantly, the venue security camera footage. It's all been disappeared. Adam Laxalt's one of the most powerful people in Nevada. The Laxalt family is one of the most powerful families in Nevada. After I got arrested, I called a friend of mine who used to work for Harry Reid, and he said, dude, what you have to do right now is apologize, plead guilty, and pray they don't elevate this to a felony, because the Lackdalt family doesn't mess around. You're in Nevada. It's the Wild West. It doesn't matter what kind of evidence you have. Bad things will happen to you if you don't make this go away quickly. But I'm stubborn, and I'm a journalist, and I want the truth to prevail. So you know, I didn't take his advice, and I'm fighting this.
Well, good, and you should. Look, as you've pointed out, this footage that you have shot, the stuff that didn't disappear, this is available, and we can see what's happening there. So to me, that just makes this all the more almost insane, because we see what's happening. You know, other evidence is disappeared. We know what happens in instances like this, and that is what is so unfortunate. And the biggest problem is that even if you prevail, you still have these legal costs. You still have to, you know, deal with this massive hit to your reputation, because as you pointed out, you search for your name and you will find all of these stories. Oh, Mike Stark has assaulted this woman. You know, he got beat up these people. He's pushing, he's shoving, he's been fired from here. It's horrendous, and it's nearly impossible to try to come back from those. You know, nobody goes back and prints the corrections. Nobody deletes the old stories so that they're not the first things that show up when you Google someone's name. It's out there. It exists, and they're not going fix it.
Do you know, I thought there might be some solidarity amongst reporters in the press. So every one of those reporters from CNN and Politico and all the Washington Post that printed news of me going to jail, I emailed them and I shared the video with them. And I said, look, this obviously didn't happen the way they said it happened. And I'm being set up here just like I was set up this last time. And this is the real story, that Republicans hate accountability. They hate the free press. They hate reporters. And you know this because you've seen Ben Jacobs tackled by Greg Gianforte up in Montana on his election eve. And what did Greg Gianforte say at first? He said Ben Jacobs attacked him. It was only when other witnesses came forward and said, no, that's not the way it happened at all, that he finally conceded, okay, well, I'm sorry. And it was only after that that he ended up being charged with assault. You see what happens at the Donald Trump rallies, where you've got just unhinged people attacking people in the media pit, not for any apparent reason, just because they are media. We're journalism is in a sorry state right now, and it's because of the Republican Party. The good news is that I'm suing all the bastards. I'm suing the RNC, the NRCC, the NRSC, the Republican Governors Association, every individual that was involved in any of this stuff. It's going to be a hard case, but I'm suing them for defamation, for conspiracy, intentional infliction of emotional distress. Mostly it's a defamation suit. It's going to be a hard case because some of these folks were federal employees, and it's very difficult to sue federal employees for intentional torts. But my lawyer says, you know, we got a shot. And if I can get to discovery and get into the emails that were flying back and forth at the NRCC and the NRSC, where I was doing most of my work up on the Hill at the Senate and Republican congressional campaign, I think we're liable to discover some pretty juicy emails, and I'm hopeful we get to it.
Well, let's,
I wouldn't be surprised if they... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, let's hope this is all successful. And I want to let all the listeners know, too. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but real quick, it's GoFundMe.com/resistancemedialegalfees. Please, this is a very important story. Mike is a very important journalist. We need your voice out there. We need your work out there. So anybody that is listening that is able to help, GoFundMe.com/resistancemedialegalfees. Please help support in any way you can. Mike, always a pleasure. I really appreciate you telling us the story today.
Thanks for giving me the chance to tell it. I think it's an important story for people to hear. Thank you very much.
Mike Stark is an investigative reporter and attorney. And when we come back, we'll tell you why Mitch McConnell is definitely the worst Republican in Washington, D.C. And if you missed any part of this show, just go to ROFpodcast.com, become a member. You'll get the full show commercial free or listen to any of our archive shows with all your favorite guests. I'm Farron Cousins. We'll be right back after the break.
Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
Welcome to the third hour of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins, in for Sam Cedar this week. Don't forget, you can support the show by going to ROFpodcast.com and signing up for the free one-hour podcast, or you can become a member and get the full show at an amazing deal. And for even more Ring of Fire, subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. New videos uploaded every single day of the week. You can also follow me on Twitter at FarronBalanced. Now let's talk about some more of this week's top stories. Let's get started this hour. We've spent part of the show talking about progressive policies, about these initiatives, about all of these great, wonderful things that we want to do for this country. But there's always a roadblock, right? I mean, it's never just that easy. We come up with these grand ideas. The presidential candidates throwing out some wonderful ideas. Elizabeth Warren with very clear and detailed roadmaps coming out pretty much every Monday. If you pay attention, she's got this new amazing policy every single Monday. I love it. But here's the thing. That roadblock, those roadblocks, they're always going to be there, as long as they keep getting reelected. And we know that, not just based on history, but based on what Mitch McConnell told voters in Kentucky earlier this week. Mitch McConnell went back to Owensboro, Kentucky, earlier this week, and he started talking about things like the Green New Deal and Medicare for All and how horrible these things would be for the United States. Here's what he had to say. He said, "We are having a legitimate debate about the virtues of socialism, and I don't want you to think it's just a 28-year-old congresswoman from New York. This is much broader than that. I've got five colleagues in the Senate, five colleagues running for president, who have signed on to the Green New Deal and Medicare for All. I don't want you to think this is just a couple of nutcases running around on the fringe. This is pervasive policy view on the other side. Are we going to turn this into a socialist country? Don't assume it cannot happen. If I'm still the majority leader of the Senate, think of me as the Grim Reaper. None of that stuff is going to pass. None of it." So saith Mitch McConnell, Republican Senate Majority Leader. None of it's going to pass. I am the Grim Reaper. These people are nutcases. Those are the big takeaways from Mitch McConnell's speech in Owensboro, Kentucky. He is the roadblock. This is a man who's been in the Senate since the 80s, okay, in case you ever needed any kind of good example as to why we need term limits on Congress. Yeah, look at Mitch McConnell. That's the guy. He is exhibit A as to why we have to have term limits. But nonetheless, he says he's going to be the Grim Reaper. He's going to be the dude that just kills all these progressive policies. And to me, what's really interesting about this is the same guy who just a couple weeks ago wrote his whiny little op-ed in Politico complaining about how obstructionist the Democrats are. They just don't want to do anything. They don't want to work with us. They don't want to pass anything. They're just awful obstructionists, even though they're not even as obstructionist as the Republicans were during the last few years of Obama. But either way, Mitch McConnell is running on a policy of blocking the policies that a majority of people in this country, left, right, center, and everything in between, actually support. Medicare for All has broad bipartisan majority support. Green New Deal has a plurality support. A $15 living wage has a majority support. Taking action on climate change outside of the Green New Deal does have broad bipartisan majority support. As does getting rid of Citizens United and banning corporate money from our elections. As does debt-free college. The list goes on and on. The public, including Republicans, a majority of them, have made it clear they want these progressive policies. What they don't want is the Grim Reaper, Mitch McConnell. That's what he called himself. I'll be the Grim Reaper. They don't want him coming along and killing it. Yet that is exactly what he told his constituents that he is going to do. He told them that. I just read you that quote, unequivocal. He's the Grim Reaper. He will kill it. And these people are nutcases. So let's talk about the nutcases in the Senate. Because it's not Bernie, it's not Elizabeth Warren, it's not Sheldon Whitehouse or Jeff Merkley or any of them. It's not AOC over in the House or Rashida Tlaib. No, it's Mitch McConnell. It's Louie Gohmert. It's Jim Inhofe. These people would be the textbook definition of nutcases. And Mitch McConnell is out there telling these people in the state with the highest rate of cancer in the country, by the way, that he doesn't care. He doesn't care what you want. He doesn't care that you support these policies. He's going to kill them, not because they're bad ideas, but just because that's who he is as a person. He doesn't ever want to work with Democrats. He hasn't wanted to work with Democrats in his 30 plus years in the U.S. Senate. And that's never going to change. Unless, of course, Mitch McConnell doesn't return to the Senate following 2020. You know, it's easy to get kind of caught up in the horse race, right? We've got what? I think 800 Democrats running for president right now. Donald Trump, who now has himself a primary challenger, Bill Weld. So we got a lot of people out there running for president. That's a lot of headlines, a lot of people coming up with policies, a lot of people not coming up with policies, a lot of people jumping on tables and saying crazy things and getting attention and speaking 800 languages, whatever it is. Different headlines, but let's never forget that presidency, that top office, that is a small part of a bigger puzzle called the United States government. Yes, it's important. Hugely important. But so is control of the Senate. And there are 22 sitting Republicans up for re-election in 2020. 22. You flip half of those, Democrats get the Senate. At this point, I don't think Democrats are in any danger of losing the House of Representatives by any stretch of the imagination. But we could win that Senate. We absolutely 100% could. And nothing would please me more than to send Mitch McConnell packing. Send him into a retirement that should have began 18 years ago. But he has limped on. And he has caused so much damage to the state of Kentucky. And I sincerely wish the people in Kentucky would wake up and understand how bad he has been for their state. As I mentioned, highest cancer rate in the entire country, in that state of Kentucky. Highest rate of cancer. And it is because of the contamination in that state. A lot of it has to do with the coal companies. And yet Mitch McConnell, knowing full well he can do nothing to revive the coal industry, has consistently, for the last few elections, run on reviving the coal industry. Trump ran on it. You can't revive this dying industry where demand globally is absolutely plummeting. Not only that, but it's an industry that has a nasty little habit of killing its workers and everyone in those communities. Most of the time, slow, painful deaths from cancers, from coal ash, from black lung, from things like that. Okay, the people in Kentucky that are voting for Mitch McConnell are experiencing this to this day. And yet they keep voting for this guy who doesn't care if they live or die. They keep voting for the guy who promises that he is going to obstruct every good policy the Democrats try to enact, even though a majority of people in this country support them. That is Mitch McConnell 2020. Because that is what he told us earlier this week. We need to take a quick break. We're going to pick up with more news of the week when we come back. I am Farron Cousins, in for Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks. Mike Papantonio's new book, entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel, Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Papp's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I am Farron Cousins from Ring of Fire on YouTube. I am sitting in for Sam Cedar this week. Right now, talking about the news, we've had a couple big reports come out this week that all talk about money. And not, you know, economics or things like that. We're talking about the bad money. And by bad money, I, of course, mean the money that is flowing unabated into our election processes. The first story is that you have Republicans, big money Republican donors, people like Roy Bailey from Dallas, who say that all of the donors who were scared off by Trump in 2016, these big money folks who refused to get behind Donald Trump in 2016, they're coming back. Man, they're coming back, and they are all giving money to Donald Trump, tens of thousands of dollars. And here's what it is. You've got a fundraising drive for Donald Trump that is going to formally begin on May 7th at a closed-door event with Trump 2020 aides in Washington, D.C. And anyone who gives over $25,000 is invited to this. And they're also going to have these campaign-sponsored retreats, briefings, dinners, all kinds of things, according to a Politico report. And I mentioned Roy Bailey. He's one of the guys that's kind of behind all this, not necessarily with the Trump campaign, but he is working to get all of these never Trump Republicans to come on board and start donating money. And he said that he has now gotten commitments from roughly 150 big money donors. He said many of these people absolutely opposed Donald Trump in 2016. Here's a direct quote from Bailey. He said, they were slow to come on board. I've had a couple of people that in 2016, they just weren't on board with candidate Trump at all. And they said, look, Roy, he has won me over. I'm all in. And the way he won them over, and I think we all understand why, is with the big, massive tax cut that didn't do anything for average Americans and did everything for the top 1%. They love that. They love that tax cut, and man, they don't want to ever see it go away. Meanwhile, tax refunds have significantly declined for average American citizens. Their tax rate, in some instances, actually went up because we're not allowed to write off a lot of the things we used to that would help reduce our taxes. So yes, we're paying more in taxes, and the wealthy elite get to pay less. In fact, if your corporate profits are high enough, you can actually write off 100% the cost of a new private jet. That's how great the top 1%'s doing. And that's why these donors who were a little iffy on Trump, that's why they're coming back. And here's another quote. This is from Jeff Verhoef, who bundled money for Marco Rubio's failed campaign. He's going to be bundling money. And this is what he had to say. This is crazy. He says, all you have to do is look at what the other side is gearing up for, and this is a pretty easy decision for a lot of people, talking about wealthy donors. From a policy standpoint, there's virtually nothing they disagree with. Then layer on top of that the choice the other side is presenting to the country, and it's a no-brainer. And Mr. Verhoef here hit on a point that I know Sam has hit on Ring of Fire for years. I've talked about it with Sam on Ring of Fire. I talk about it on our YouTube channel constantly. And that is, as Verhoef just said, from a policy standpoint, there's no difference. There's no disagreement. Because Donald Trump isn't any different than any other Republican who could be in that Oval Office right now, except for he's a little harsh. He's a little abrasive. He's a bit of a bigot sometimes. And they don't like that. They don't like it being public. They don't like him bullying people on Twitter. They prefer to do it behind closed doors where other people can't see what a horrible human being they are. He does it out in the open, and they don't like that. But when it comes to tax cut, when it comes to unwinnable wars, escalation in the Middle East, cutting regulations, they're all the same. There is no difference. There is no difference between any of these Republicans. We would be looking at the exact same policies had Marco Rubio won the presidency, had Ted Cruz won it, or Lindsey Graham, any of them. Carly Fiorina, hell, going all the way back to Herman Cain and Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, all of these people, we'd have the same policies. This is what they've always believed. This is what they always will believe. Now, the other story I mentioned about money has to do with Democrats, and this one's a little disappointing, although completely predictable. Lee Fong over at The Intercept did a piece earlier this week talking about the fact that we have several Democrats who signed on to the pledge that, no, I'm not going to take lobbyist money, I'm not going to take corporate PAC money, and then, oops, in the financial disclosures that came out on April 17th, we find out, yeah, they're taking lobbyist and PAC money, all right. And of course, I don't even, you know, here's the thing. You probably already know who I'm talking about. Like, if I didn't say their names, I am sure you would be able to guess in your mind who the three people are. Actually, technically it is four. Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Beto O'Rourke, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Kamala Harris, obviously, biggest recipient here. She has taken donations from registered corporate lobbyists in South Carolina, New York, California. These include people who are lobbyists for pipeline companies, lobbyists for Google, all kinds of corporate interests helping to fund her campaign. Beto O'Rourke taking money from Chevron lobbyists and other utility company lobbyists. And then you have Cory Booker, and Cory's a little different because Cory also signed on the pledge saying, I'm not going to take any federal lobbyist money. And he hasn't, technically. But man, he has taken a lot of money from state lobbyists. See, Cory Booker found a loophole. He said, no, hold up. I only said I'm not taking money from federal lobbyists. I'm totally on board taking money from state lobbyists. And then you have all three of them, along with Pete Buttigieg, who have all taken money from Jay Carney, who is the former White House press secretary for Obama. And he is now the top corporate affairs person at Amazon. And they've all taken money from him, one of the biggest corporations on the planet right now. So yeah, Trump's taking a lot of corporate money. Democrats taking corporate money, lobbyist money right now. We can do better than that. There's plenty of candidates that aren't going to take corporate money. And those are going to be the ones that I'm supporting in this primary. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm taking your questions from Twitter. I'm Farron Cousins and from Sam Cedar. We'll be right back.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I am Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar this week. Going to close out the show here, his last 30 minutes, by doing one of my favorite things, taking your questions from Twitter. All week, people have been sending them in. Just use the hashtag AskROF. Send your questions. I love answering them. Let's go right to it right now. Our first question from Green Eggs in Hamby, at Green Egg Hamby, asks, I know the hashtag impeach Donald Trump has grown rapidly, but is there a method that could remove or impeach McConnell prior to the 2020 elections, maybe in the Constitution? Unfortunately, there's not much we can do about Mitch McConnell right now. And that is incredibly disappointing. You know, Mitch McConnell, as I had previously talked about earlier in this hour, he's already made it clear he's going to block anything progressives try to do. Basically, anything a Democrat puts forward, Mitch McConnell is going to be against it. And he's going to get the rest of his Republicans in the Senate to do the same thing. So, no, we have to wait till 2020. But what we can do is get rid of him in 2020 by harping on this, by bringing it up, by keeping this issue alive, by reminding the people in this country how horrible Mitch McConnell truly is. You know, that's something that I do on our YouTube channel all the time. I do not let Mitch McConnell get away with anything. All of his dirty tricks, all of his horrible statements, all of his bad policies, we hold him accountable and we remind people how awful he's been throughout his decades in the United States Senate. And that's what we can do. And we can also remember that it is not just Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is by far the worst because he is the leader, but there are plenty of
others in the Senate. Jim Inhofe is the name that comes to mind for me above all else, because Inhofe is absolute trash. I mean, this is a man who just a few years ago was angry that his granddaughter asked him why he's not doing anything about climate change and why he spreads lies. He thought that meant that she had been brainwashed. I mean, Inhofe is absolutely one of the worst of the worst, and there are so many more like him. I mean, Florida just sent you Rick Scott to the Senate, guy that should be, arguably, in jail, but somehow served two terms as Florida's governor, and now he's our senator, unseating Bill Nelson. Yeah, we don't always make the best decisions down here in Florida electorally, in case you haven't noticed. I like to think I do. I haven't voted for any of these people, including the man who represents my congressional district, Matt Gaetz. But nonetheless, we make really bad decisions down here as a state, and hopefully that's going to change with our 1.4 million new eligible former felons who can register to vote unless Republicans have their way and take that away. But again, the point is, we got to bring it up. We got to talk about it. We got to keep it alive. Every time Mitch McConnell does something horrible for the American public, we have to talk about it. And I know a lot of folks in progressive media, where everything has to go up on YouTube and it has to get super high views because that's how the money comes in. And the money's with Trump headlines. I know this. I can look at the traffic on our own YouTube channel. However, sometimes you just have to sacrifice it, right? What are we in this for? Are we in this for the money? Or are we in this to educate the public and make the country a better place? Because I'm going to tell you, I'm in that second camp. I need money, don't get me wrong. But I would rather watch this country succeed and move to the left and enact these progressive policies that the country wants. And so that's why we have to talk about these. That's why we have to talk about issues like climate change and gun control and things like that. It may not be the biggest attention grabber. It may not be the highest trafficked YouTube video we put out. But I can tell you those are among the most important. Thank you very much for your question. Next one comes from Alex Moret, at Alex Moret 6. He asks, will the United States ever be free from corporate corruption and actual fake news like Daily Caller, Breitbart, etc.? I wish I could say yes, but I don't know. Because here's the thing, and your question, you know, kind of hits on this, and that we have a two-pronged corporate attack on the United States right now. Obviously, we have the corporate money that is destroying our elections. It's destroying our elected officials. It is corrupting them. It is making them do horrible things that go against the will of the public. That's number one. And a majority of people, including Republicans, all do support getting that corporate money out of elections. I mean, there's no question about that. Everybody wants the money gone. Question is, will we ever be able to get it? Yes, we will. If we make the right choices in this Democratic primary and then in the 2020 election, I think we can easily make that happen. The other prong of the attack, something that unfortunately we cannot constitutionally do anything about it. And that is the corporate money that funds these right-wing idiots and their little fake news sites. And to me, I got to tell you, this is something that really bothers me. You know, I just mentioned, you know, we got to worry about the views on YouTube and making the money and getting the subscribers and getting the people to Patreon over for those of us on the left. On the right? Man, all you got to do is just be willing to go out there and make a complete fool of yourself, and you'll find Mercers, you'll find Waltons, you'll find Cokes, you'll find all kinds of corporate donors ready to step up and write you these magnificent paychecks. How wonderful must it be to be a right-wing talking head? I mean, seriously, how easy is Ben Shapiro's life? I have to imagine it is a walk in the park. Same thing with people like Charlie Kirk and Candace Owens. All these people. You don't ever have to research. You don't ever have to worry about fact-checking. You don't have to worry about actually knowing what in the hell you're talking about. and you never have to worry about money because these big corporate faceless entities always have your back. They will always pay you to go out there and be as dumb as humanly possible. And they like to tell us, I'm independently funded. I'm independently funded. No, they're not. You know, Charlie Kirk with Turning Point USA, the seed money for that came from the Mercers. They started that. They helped fund it. And then when you track the other funders of people who claim that they're not taking corporate money, but you are. You may not even realize it because I don't think any of these people are that bright. They figured out a good grift, but that doesn't make them smart. But what they do and what the right wing does, and this is something, again, we've talked about on Ring of Fire for 15 years now, is they essentially funnel money through these different organizations. You know, the Olin Foundation, the SCAIF Foundation, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the other public policy for, you know, people foundation. I just made that one up, but it's how it is. When you go to any of these sites, when you look at SourceWatch and they talk about the funding for any of these individual groups, there's going to be these massive lists of different foundations that provide money for them. And then you go look at that foundation and see where that foundation gets its money. And it's essentially another list of foundations, a lot of whom are the same as on the other one. So they are kind of all passing money back and forth. But if you eventually trace these and keep following it and keep pulling on those threads and getting to the heart of it, that's when you discover, oh, it's the Koch brothers, it's the Exxons, it's the Monsantos, it's the Dows, it's the Pfizers, it's the Mercks, all the usual suspects funding these organizations that fund the foundations that then go and fund all of these right-wing talkers and the bloggers and the Twitter stars and the pundits and the TPUSAs and everybody else. And sadly, we can't stop that. And even sadder, there's no mechanism like that on the left. I know Republicans love to tell us that George Soros is over here funding everything. No, he's not. He absolutely 100% is not. And trust me, if he was, man, I would line up to get one of those Soros checks that Republicans love to talk about. But it's never materialized. It's never been offered. In fact, through my work at various other progressive organizations, every time we've gone to him, nothing. Not a dime. So, sorry to destroy your narrative there, Republicans. But go ahead. Keep using your little foundations and organizations to funnel money to all of your stupid little talking heads. We all know the truth, and so do those people. We have to take a quick break. Going to be right back with more Twitter questions when we come back. I'm Farron Cousins, and for Sam Cedar on Ring of Fire Radio.
I'll take the long way round. Oh, I'll find my own way down. Oh, as I should.
On the heels of the critically acclaimed legal thriller, Law and Disorder, comes Law and Vengeance, the latest novel from famed trial attorney Mike Papantonio. Law and Vengeance follows the law firm of Bergman Dica Thomas, who is now in the crosshairs of a weapons manufacturer. But this is not a law firm that plays by all the rules. Based on a real case, Law and Vengeance, the riveting new legal thriller by Mike Papantonio, is available wherever books are sold.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Ring of Fire Radio.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I am Farron Cousins in for Sam Cedar this week. We're taking questions on Twitter right now. So if you've got a question, please send it to us using the hashtag AskROF. Our next question comes from Scotty Cameron, at ScottySayCam97. And Scotty asks, what do you make of Andrew Yang and his universal basic income proposal? Do you think it's a bold step forward? And do you think Yang has a shot at the nomination? At this point, I don't know that Yang would necessarily have a shot at the nomination. And that's only because it has nothing to do with his policies. It only has to do with the fact that he doesn't have the name recognition. He's not getting the same kind of media coverage that everybody else is. So I don't think the media would ever give him the attention that he deserves, if that makes sense. Because they fall in love and out of love so quickly. You know, a month ago, Beto O'Rourke was the rising star, not just of the United States Democratic Party, but of the planet, according to the media. Beto O'Rourke was it. And then it just kind of died off and nobody really talks about Beto anymore. Now it's all Mayor Pete. Pete Buttigieg, who's attacking Bernie Sanders supporters and comparing them to Trump supporters. His star, I'm assuming, is going to fall faster than even Beto's did, or at least I'm hoping. The more that man speaks, the less I like him. And I say that after having said, I think back in early February, that he was in my top three. Yeah, he's below my bottom three at this point. But back to your question, the universal basic income, I'm not quite sold yet, only because the plan would entail getting rid of other benefits. And I don't know if I'm okay with that, or if that is a good plan. Globally, when you look at it, other places that have enacted some form of universal basic income, it has not worked out very well. Because I have done some of the research on that and looked at some of the other countries. It's not typically something that works. That's not to say that Yang's plan would not be successful here. I don't want to be one of those people that say, oh, they tried it over there, it doesn't work. No, every country's different and it could work. And I think in theory, it is a good plan. But I don't think Yang is going to get enough attention to get enough name recognition to really, you know, push it that far. And I mean that with absolutely no offense to Yang. Please do not take this as me attacking him or saying he's not important or saying that his plan is stupid. That is not what I'm doing. I like the plan. I would like to know more about it. I would like to be a little bit more clear, and I would like for my concerns about it to be eased. And I've seen a couple interviews with him, and that has warmed me to the idea, because at first I thought, yeah, that's very unrealistic, but I'm warming to it. But I don't think the media will ever give him a fair shake. I just don't. You know, we're going to hear about probably always the top three candidates, and we know who the top two are, Bernie and Biden. And the top three is whoever the hell the media says it is. And that's what's awful. The media is absolutely able to manipulate public policy polling by just devoting more attention to one person. And it's not the other way around. They're not just suddenly paying attention to one person because the polls changed. The polls change after the media starts focusing on one person. It's what happened with Beto. It's what happened with Mayor Pete. It's why Kamala Harris was so high up in the polls and then they forgot about her. Really, honest to God, the media has forgotten about all of the women running for president. And to me, that is appalling and that is absurd. I love Elizabeth Warren. I love her policies. She is absolutely one of my top two. And I don't even know if she's number one or number two. And I don't even know if it matters. But absolutely a disgrace that she is so far down in the polls and that the media is not giving her and her policy proposals the attention that they deserve. She is so much better than that. And the media is once again failing us, just like they failed us in 2016 here. Another question here from Matthew Jacobson at M3TTJCBSN. Wow. the question is, can the Democratic Party be reformed, or is it lost, and will it fracture and split into two separate parties? Can it be reformed? If we get corporate money out, 100% it can. You get corporate money out and return the Democratic Party to what it was, then yeah, you absolutely can save it. And everybody can come together. We're going to be best friends again. We're all going to get along and we're going to push progressive policies. As long as corporate money continues to influence certain wings of the Democratic Party, there is no reform. There is no coming back together. The two sides are going to continue to split, just like the Republican Party is splitting right now. The media doesn't like to talk about that one as much, though. They like to act like the Democratic Party is in the midst of some kind of civil war, forgetting that the Republicans are basically being split between the people who don't like the government and the people who don't like the government and also don't like non-white people. I mean, that's the split in the Republican Party. But for the Democrats, I think it is more fundamental. It's policy-based. It is based on what we think the best vision of this country is and what the government's role should be in that. But as far as fixing it, as coming back together, I don't know. I really don't know. And I don't know that we even should want them to. You know, we have so many good people that I guess would be on what's considered the far left of the Democratic Party, pushing these wonderful policies, going for broke on a lot of these policy issues, pushing us to where we need to be as a country, pushing us so far, in fact, that a lot of these centrist corporatist Democrats now have no choice but to embrace these progressive policies. So maybe they break off and start their own party. Or maybe they stay and continue to pull the party further to the left from the inside. That may actually end up being the more effective path for them. And that's it for this week's Ring of Fire. I want to say thank you to everyone who's taken the time to support this show and become a member of our podcast. If you aren't a member, do us a favor and please help support independent media by going to ROFpodcast.com. Signing up for the full show commercial-free is one of the best ways to help Ring of Fire Radio. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and watch our videos on YouTube. We've got new videos up 7 days a week, so make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel to stay in the loop. I'm Farron Cousins, in for Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio. A broom is drearily sweeping up the broken pieces of yesterday's life. Somewhere a queen is weeping.
Hey folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.